Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Imagine this. You wake up in the morning and you don't know where you are. The person sleeping next to you is a stranger and much older than you, and you've got no idea how you got there. You go into the bathroom and you look in the mirror, and the person looking back at you is 20 years older than you ought to be. This is the dilemma of the main character in S.J. Watson's first novel called Before I Go to Sleep. It's based on genuine medical cases of people that suffer a rare form of amnesia after they've had an accident of some kind. And the nature of the injury means that the brain can't really retain much of a memory of the previous day. So every day, you wake up with the shock of, where am I? How did I get to be so old? And who on earth are you? S.J. Watson's debut novel has become an instant international success, and now it's being made into a movie by Ridley Scott's production company. S.J. Watson, or can I call you Steve? Hello.
Yes. Hi, hi. Of course you can call me Steve, it's fine. Yes.
Hello,
hi.
Steve. When did you first decide you wanted to write?
Oh, well, I think really, I probably from the age of about eight, I think. My earliest ambition, my very earliest ambition was to be a dustbin man, actually, believe it or not. And But I think that was really that I...
We'd call blimey trousers and...
Yeah, yeah. I think that was more a case of I was thinking somebody must have said to me, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I'd kind of looked out of the window and seen people emptying the dustbins and thought, well, that looks kind of easy and not very stressful, so that'll do. So my first ambition was to be a dustbin man. But yeah, and pretty soon after that, I decided I wanted to be a novelist. I've always loved books and I've always loved reading and writing, and I would say probably about 8 years of age.
You took up science instead.
Yeah, well, kind of when the question started getting a bit more serious about what I was going to do with kind of to earn a living and to earn money, basically, I suppose, and people asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, write books, write novels. And they said to me, or most people said to me, you know, it's not a very good career choice.
Ah, those people. Yeah. Who are those people anyway?
But mostly my father, to be honest. So, yeah, so I decided to play safe. I was good at science at school, so I took a science path.
What was your job with the National Health Service in Britain?
Yeah, well, I specialise in audiology, hearing and balance science. My first job was working with people with balance problems, people who found, you know, walking difficult, who had suffered from vertigo. But then for most of my career, I've been working with hearing impaired children.
When you say it like that, it almost seems, you know, balance problems. Sounds, I suppose, at first to be a pretty benign problem, but in fact, in some ways, I can't imagine anything worse.
Well, no, it's actually, yeah, I mean, you're right, and a lot of people do think, oh, it must be fairly trivial, but no, it can be really, really disabling. And what I found really interesting, actually, working with these kinds of patients, is often it's their balance problems leads to a very complicated psychological issues of agoraphobia is quite common with people with balance disorder, because what will happen is they'll have an attack on the street quite often, and people will assume that they're drunk or that they've taken some illegal drug and they're out of control, and and they get very embarrassed about having another attack again. So they quite often people will get frightened to go out and frightened to be seen in public in case they have an attack of vertigo.
Already, I don't know if I'm drawing too long a bow here, but but it does, that kind of condition is the sort of thing where it's a bit like the character in your book, where normal kind of day-to-day life we take for granted is thrown right out of whack, and the everyday normal world is suddenly strange and unfamiliar and terrifying.
I think you're right, actually. And, you know, this is an interesting thing for me, because originally I thought with Before I Go to Sleep I was writing a book which had nothing at all to do with my day job and was completely removed from the whole world of hearing and balance and all the things I was doing in the NHS. But more and more, as I'm getting more distance from it, I can see, you know, how, you're totally right, that this idea of my character being, as you say, completely out of whack with normal society and not being able to fit in with normality is totally consistent with the people with balance problems, and also with the children with hearing impairment as well, because they're also, you know, they may find normal communication and therefore in many ways normal life very difficult. Subconsciously, if not consciously, I was probably writing about something very, very much influenced by my day job, my work in health
service. You were still writing while you were doing that, though, weren't you?
Yeah, I've kind of written all my life, really, to a greater or lesser extent. You know, I'd go through periods of maybe up to a year with writing very little, but it's always kind of been there. But in my early to mid-30s, I sort of reconnected in a way with my childhood ambition and began to take writing much more seriously. And I suppose I kind of reflected back on the decision I'd made at the age of 16, 14, when I decided not to be a writer but to be a scientist instead, and thought, well, you know, there's no reason why I can't do both. So kind of in my early 30s, it kind of stepped up a gear, I suppose, and I started writing a bit more seriously and a bit more, you know, regularly.
Once you started to write, I don't know, short stories and poetry, I think, as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've written dreadful poetry in my life. I think I've probably written some quite good poetry as well, but as a teenager, I wrote endless streams of awful poetry.
Do you have to write 100 bad poems before you can write a good one?
I suspect that's true.
Were you a bit shy with it? Were you slightly terrified to show other people what you'd written?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm quite shy with most things, in fact, which is kind of ironic, me sitting here in a radio studio saying that.
We asked you to come in,
so that's okay. I'm very hard on myself, I think, in everything, really, but certainly in writing. I expect great things of myself, and so I was determined never to show anything to anybody unless I thought it was good, and I'm the hardest person for me to please.
So there you are, writing quietly on the side, shyly on the side. How does this all change?
Several things kind of came together at the same time, I suppose. I was kind of in my mid-30s, so my 40th birthday was looming on the horizon, and that's a kind of milestone birthday, isn't it? I think where people maybe reflect back on their life up to date and think, you know, am I going in the direction I thought I'd be going in? Am I achieving the things I would wanted to have achieved as a child or as a younger person? And so that was kind of looming. And but also I was becoming more senior in my job in the health service. I'd risen to the point I was deputy head of a really quite large department. So it was very busy, it was very stressful. It was leaving me with less and less time, and not only time but also energy to write. So I'd come home from work absolutely exhausted. I think all these kind of things were coming together to mean I was doing less and less writing, and it was making me unhappy. And I really realised actually that writing was important to me, and it was something I needed to do. And I reached a point where, as I say, I was deputy head of a department, and my line manager, my boss, the head of the department, was about to retire. And the next logical step for me would have been, if not to get his job, but to get a job at that level of being head of a department.
And if that's not really what you want to do, taking on all that responsibility, it's an act of bad faith in some ways.
Yeah, and that's I had a real kind of crisis moment when I just thought it's really not what I want to do. And if I see myself in, you know, that kind of cliched question of where do you want to be in 10, 5, 10, 15 years' time, it wasn't head of a department in an NHS hospital. So I thought, you know, well, I can't just keep barreling down this path that I'm on without kind of making some changes.
So what were the changes?
Well, I remember I went to my boss and I said I'd really like to go part-time, and he said you can't. So I basically made the decision that I would leave and get another job. It was also kind of partly inspired by an article I read in a magazine which is all about the Rolling Stones. It was an article written by a woman called Jenny Rogers, who's a life coach in the UK, and she'd written this article about the Rolling Stones, and she was saying that most people, when they see the Rolling Stones, when they think of the Rolling Stones on stage at their age, you know, they think, what on earth are they doing that for? You know, why are they, you know, they don't need the money. Why are they embarrassing themselves by cavorting around singing these songs when they're in their 60s? But if you see the Stones perform, she said, you know, you can really see that they actually just love what they're doing. And that's why they do it. It's not because they need the money. It's because they just love singing those songs and playing those songs and getting on the stage and entertaining people. And she said, you know, if you're facing a crossroads in your life, just think what you would do, not because it earns money, but just because you just love doing it. And I knew that was writing for me. So I thought, I've got to make some changes.
On Conversations today, my guest is S.J. Watson, also known as Steve Watson, a man whose debut novel has become seemingly an instant international bestseller. It's called Before I Go to Sleep, and it's the story of a woman who wakes up every day with no memory of the previous 24 hours and every single day has got to put the circumstances of her life together. You signed on in England to the Faber Academy, of course. What did you learn there you didn't know before?
That's a really difficult question. I mean, the Faber Academy came at just the right time for me. I started working my part-time post in January and the Faber Academy started in February. So it was everything kind of came together at once. And it was a real opportunity for me to really focus on my writing and sort of really devote those 6 months to really thinking of myself as a writer and really, really focusing on that. But in terms of what the course taught me, there were so many things, it's really hard to...
What were you wrong about? What myths were floating
around
in your
head? Well, I suppose the myth about publishing was the big one, actually. You know, I think most people who are unpublished, aspiring writers, especially novelists, have this idea that the publishing world is closed against them, and that agents and editors and publishers are desperately trying to kind of keep people away, because that's the kind of impression that you get. But actually what I learned is the opposite, in fact, is that agents and editors are desperately trying to find great books. They love books, usually. Well, they love books always, in my experience, and they're just desperately trying to find another great book that they can publish.
So you became more optimistic about the process rather than less so.
I mean, yeah, optimistic about the process, but also we were kind of constantly being reminded how many manuscripts agents get on their desk. I think my agency gets about 300 a week, which is kind of sobering when you think there are so many out there. So how do you make yours stand out, I suppose?
You've got to write a great page one, clearly.
Well, yeah, yeah. And it helps. I think you have to write 300, great 300 pages.
To follow up that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, but especially page one. Yeah.
So then the idea for this novel pops into your head. Was this around about the same time you were doing the course?
Yeah, this is another thing which happened at about the same time. So as I say, it really was like all these things kind of coming together.
So you're right, in other words, yeah. You really did need to quit that job.
Yeah.
So in order to actually have time to think about what you needed to do.
Yeah, it was definitely something which, it was a bit of a leap in the dark. And I mean, I don't want to kind of overplay it. I was never at the point where I might be able not be able to pay my mortgage.
Still, it's what happened, what you hoped would happen. I mean, you left and suddenly, unburdened by institutional responsibility, your mind roamed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think because it was the first time I'd ever actually sacrificed something in order to write, I felt like I'd put my NHS career not only on hold, but I'd actually taken a backward step because it was in a junior role that I'd gone from being very senior to being quite junior. So I did feel I was risking something. So I think the stakes were a bit higher, and it made me more determined really to give writing as good a shot as I could give it. So yeah, so I was looking for ideas of a novel to be working on. I'd kind of been working on other projects, but I thought I needed a brand new project, something I can take from ground up in on this Faber course. And one of the many things I did was to read obituaries, and I read an obituary of a man called Henry Molaison who had amnesia until he died.
Tell me his story, because this is a beautifully illustrative story of the person with this strange condition, a condition that really goes to the heart in some ways of what it is to be human.
I think so. I think it does, and it's something which perhaps that even as I began to write the book, I wasn't aware of how profound an issue I was kind of tackling, I suppose, with memory and amnesia. But no, Henry Molaison was born in the 20s in Connecticut in the States, and he had very severe epilepsy, which meant essentially he couldn't live a normal life. He was fitting. His fits were so frequent and so severe that he couldn't hold down relationships. He couldn't work. And in an effort to cure him, he underwent an experimental surgical procedure at the age of 27 in which a surgeon removed the parts of his brain which were thought to be responsible for his epilepsy.
God, this would have been the mid-40s or late 40s thereabouts.
Early 50s, actually.
Right.
But yeah, it had never been done before. And what they didn't realise, but because of what happened to Henry, medical science came to understand that part of the brain, as well as being responsible for his epilepsy, also is responsible for storing memory. So the obituary described how, from the moment he woke up from the anaesthetic, he couldn't form any new memories. His memory lasted about 8 minutes.
Did he have a solid bed of memory leading up to a certain point?
Yeah, he could remember up until I think about 25 years of age, and then the 2 years of his life I think were a bit murky. And he had the operation when he was 27. But from 27 onwards, he formed no new memories. There was a really touching. I found it touching anyway. I found out fairly recently actually that he'd worked with the same doctor for decades, and she'd studied him and she'd become close to him, and she thought of him as a friend. And at the very end of his life, apparently, she could say to him, "Have we ever met before?" And of course, they'd been meeting every week, if not more often, for years and years and years. But she would say to him, "Have we ever met before?" And at the very end of his life, Henry would say, "I think we have." And he thought that she was a friend from high school.
So she saw him several times a week.
Mm, mm.
And every time she would meet him.
Yeah, she had to introduce herself. Yeah,
as it started anew.
Absolutely. And that, I think that was reading about her and her relationship with Henry really sparked this idea of, If he didn't know somebody who he met every week, how well did he actually know himself? And I started thinking about how important our memory is to our sense of our own identity and who we actually are. And it just really struck me. He was 82 when he died. And I thought, to be 82 and yet have no memories from the age of 25, 26 would be, you know, you're such a different person at those two ages that how could you link the two?
You have to assume he was living that 50-plus year period in a state of low-level to high-level anxiety.
Well, I think my understanding is that he must have been, yeah, although I think I deliberately chose not to research his case too much, actually, during the writing of the book. So everything I've kind of learned about Henry Molaison, I've sort of read fairly recently. And I think, actually, he led a fairly fulfilled life. You know, he was well looked after. And I think, actually, he was more in a state of confusion than anxiety. I think his mind was constantly kind of resetting itself every eight minutes or so.
Every eight minutes?
Yeah, his memory, I think, lasted just a few minutes.
So often people would have to reintroduce themselves during the course of the same day.
Yeah,
in fact,
people would begin conversations with him, and midway through he'd repeat himself, and because he'd forgotten, what they'd been talking about.
I find that painfully sad. Or sad, is that the word? Melancholy? I don't know what that is.
I think melancholy. I think it's. There were other cases as well. There's a very, very sad case of a conductor in the UK who had amnesia caused by an illness that affected his brain. And I think he has one of the worst cases of amnesia on record. His mind is resetting itself totally. And there is some documentary footage of him, and it's absolutely heartbreaking to watch, because his wife she leaves the room to go and, I don't know, make a cup of tea or use the loo or whatever it might be. And then she comes back in the room, and she's been gone for 2-3 minutes sometimes. And he throws his arm around her and he says, "Where have you been? Where have you been? You left me here." And he's, it's absolutely heartbreaking to watch. It really is.
So that brings us to your novel, Before I Go to Sleep. This sparked something in you, this knowledge of this case.
Yeah.
And writing the story. Interestingly, the main character who suffers from short-term memory loss, something that she loses on a daily basis, essentially. She's a woman, Christine. And why Christine and not Christopher?
Well, there are a couple of explanations, really. And the first and probably the main reason, in fact, is that when I read this obituary, I had a mental image of a woman looking at herself in a mirror, as you described earlier, and seeing a person reflected back who was not the person she expected to see.
He was 20, 25 years older.
And it was, I think it was that mental image just suggested itself, and it was a woman. And so the character of Christine came to me almost fully formed in an instant, which sounds kind of odd, I think. But she did sort of appear to me, and I toyed with the idea of writing it from a man's perspective, but really only for a few seconds. And I think it's because some of the issues I wanted to discuss... Well, one of the reasons is some of the issues I wanted to discuss and raise and ponder are specific to a woman in that position, I think.
Yeah, there's a sense of vulnerability too, isn't there? She's a woman who wakes up every day sharing a bed with a much older man who she does not know. Being a woman, she'd like to feel more vulnerable under those circumstances.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk a lot about love and about the changing nature of love, and also about, in a way, about power within relationships. And I think, although I could have explored that from a male perspective, I think it would have been a very different book, and one that I wouldn't have found so interesting to write, and probably wouldn't have been as interesting to read.
I suppose you have to ask yourself the question, love within a marriage changes over 20-odd years or so, which is the length of time she's been married to this man who's now a stranger to her.
Yeah.
But when you don't have the memory on a day-to-day basis, I wonder how it would evolve.
Yeah, I was interested in this idea of, as we were talking earlier about the ambitions, the dreams, the hopes that you have as a young person, and whether you've fulfilled, examining your life as an older person. And to me, the book is in a way about somebody who kind of went to sleep at the age of 17 and woke up at the age of 47, and looks back on her life and says, looks at her husband, for example, and says, "Well, this is the man I married, and I may have wanted to have married Brad Pitt or whoever, but this is the person I've ended up with. And actually, is that okay? And is he as well as I could have done? Is this person the best that I could have done, or should I have held that for better?"
And, so it becomes like an arranged marriage then, doesn't it? Arranged by pre-accident self.
For her, yeah, I think so. And I also wanted to explore this idea of her looking at this man and thinking, "I don't really feel in love with you, but actually I've been married to you for 30 years, so actually maybe most people don't feel in love with their husband on a day-to-day basis after that length of time."
Of course they do.
Well, I'm just asking these questions. I'm not answering them.
Like with me at the moment is S.J. Watson, also known as Steve Watson. Steve is the author of Before I Go to Sleep, his debut novel, which has become an almost instant bestseller. Having written this book while you're doing your writing class, tell me how you pitched it to Claire, who was now your agent.
Yeah, well, that was I was really lucky. Claire came to on the last night of our course to do a seminar really on what she looks for in a manuscript, I suppose,
and what that's what taking notes.
Yeah, well, completely. but then I got chatting to her. We had a little party afterwards because, as I say, it was the final night of the course, and we had a little party, and I just got chatting to Claire, and she said, "Oh, what is your book about?" And that week we'd been working on our 20-word pitches. So I had an elevator pitch, I think they call it in the States, don't they? And I had this 20 words that kind of encapsulated the novel to give to her. And so I reeled off these 20 words. And she just said, "Oh, that sounds interesting." So we had a 15-minute conversation about the book and the ideas behind it and how I'd come to write it and so on. And she just said, "Oh, that sounds good. When it's finished, do send it to me." And there is no bigger incentive, no stronger incentive to finishing a manuscript than a top literary agent saying, "Oh, when it's finished, I'd like to see it." So I kind of really buckled down then.
And when you did send it to her?
Yeah, no, well, she obviously liked it. She could see something in it that she liked. And we worked on it. We did an edit together to get the book kind of finished. And then we sent it out to editors.
Again, you were describing that in a very low-key sort of way. In fact, there was a bidding war, wasn't there?
There was. It was a most bizarre and surreal experience. I remember Claire inviting me to her office to discuss the new draft, which turned out to be the finished draft, really. And she introduced me to. She said, "This is Jake. He's our foreign rights director." And I literally had no idea why she was introducing me to their foreign rights director. And I thought it was because they shared an office. And so we'd be having a chat while Jake was kind of trying to get on with work. But it turned out, Jake turned around and for 15 minutes was explaining his strategy of how he was going to send the book out to various different countries around the world. And I remember still thinking, is he actually talking about Before I Go to Sleep? Is he really talking about my book? And I didn't really sink in. And I remember I came out of the office and phoned my partner and said, "They seem to think they can sell it to more than one country." So, I was completely mind blown when we sent the book out, and very quickly people started saying we'd like to publish it.
Indeed, turn it into a movie. Ridley Scott's people sent you an email, and you had to say no initially, didn't you?
Well, that was an odd thing as well. Yeah, it was a lunchtime in my hospital, and I was checking my emails, and there was an odd email from someone whose name I didn't recognise. But it was the subject was Before I Go to Sleep, and it turned out to be from someone not from Ridley Scott, but from someone who works very closely with Ridley Scott, saying that they'd got hold of the book and read it and really loved it and wanted to bring it to the screen. And I remember the email said, "Ridley's in town, so we could probably organise a meeting if you'd like to meet him." And of course, I'd love to meet Ridley Scott. but I had to say no, because my agent said, "Well, we need to keep a level playing field. There may be other people interested, so you can't meet Ridley Scott."
How did they get hold of the book? It hadn't even been put out.
I'd have no idea. I have suspicions. No, I think it was out there. It was out there for publishing. So we hadn't actually sent it out for consideration for film and drama. But I think obviously somebody had read it and passed it on to somebody. He'd passed it on to somebody. He'd passed it on to someone in Ridley's team.
And so now there's talk of Cate Blanchett in the lead role.
Amongst others. Yeah, I can't say too much. No, I've read the script, and the script is really good. It's a brilliant script that Rowan Joff, who's writing it and will be directing it, has done. And it's with various actresses at the moment. But
I'm glad of you. You'd made that decision then to quit that.
Pretty happy, job. Yeah. Although, I am, obviously, I'm ecstatically happy, but it's changed my life. But I remember when I was on the Faber course, towards the end of the course, so this is before the book was even finished and certainly before there was any talk of publishing deals or film deals, I remember thinking I made the right choice, because I felt so much happier with that balance of my day job and also having lots of time to write. I think you asked me earlier what the course taught me, and I think the biggest thing it taught me is that actually I need to write. It's part of who I am. It's part of what I do. And the course taught me that. So I was ecstatically happy before any of this had actually happened. But it's nice.
have you given some thought about the very nature of your own memories? The stories we tell ourselves about our lives, when you look at that kind of strange, is it a film reel? I don't know. What is it? ViewMaster slides or of your own life and the memories that kind of stand out? They get blurrier, of course, as time goes by.
Yeah.
What do you think of the nature of what memory is?
Yeah, it fascinates me, actually. And I think, memory is, it's so interesting. There are so many studies into memory and into how we remember things and the things that we choose to remember. I think it's almost like writing a novel in a way. We almost write our own story, and we choose which scenes to to recreate in our mind and to kind of hold on to, and other scenes just kind of disappear. But I've just been struck time and time again by how our memory, we can remember very different things. You know, two people can remember the same incident in a very different way. And what affects us is actually the way we remember it, not necessarily the truth.
I've had a situation sitting next to a friend who related a story of something that happened to him. It's a great anecdote, had a funny line at the end. But it happened to me.
Yes, no, I've had that too with my partner, especially. But yeah,
and I had to pull him up, and the shock when he realised, yeah, that didn't happen to me. It did happen to you. It was
and yet your friend probably totally believed that it happened to them. Yeah, absolutely. And that's what's so fascinating. There are some really interesting studies of the way memories can be manipulated by other people. But probably that's a too long a story for the time we've got left.
Steve, lovely to meet you.
You too.
And thank you so much for being my guest.
It's been great to be here. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.